Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. The assassination of Charlie Kirk, a prominent conservative figure, shocked many across the country and around the world. It has many wondering what's next and if political violence may become more normal. Political violence is nothing new, with prominent figures from all sides of the aisle experiencing it. But has it been increasing in recent years? And is there a way to lower the temperature in America? Whose responsibility should that be? Joining us now is Laura Dugan, the Ralph D. Mershon Professor of Human Security and Professor of Sociology at Ohio State University. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, we got her mic on. Yep. Okay. Thank you for being here, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Trevor Brown, Dean of the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. Welcome to All Sides.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for this important conversation.
All right. So I guess I'm going to start with, has there been an increase in political violence in recent years, or does it just feel like that? And either one of you can take it first. Laura?
I will take that one.
Yeah.
Yes, there has most definitely been an increase in political violence here in the United States. I have been studying this very closely, and we have seen a rise beginning around the second term of Obama of extremist violence here in the U.S. There's been mass shootings. Some have been a little bit ambiguous in terms of motive, but there's been evidence that it's come from the right, with Nazi symbolism written on notebooks and with the Parkland shooter and things like that. But there's been a rise that is continuing today. So, yeah, we have concerns.
So when we think back to when I say the phrase, you know, political violence is nothing new in America, it makes us think back to, you know, JFK, Martin Luther King Jr., RFK, RFK. Trevor, what do you think of political violence in like that 60s era compared to now?
So first off, I should say that occurred before I was born.
Same. So, I know. Right. Yeah. Well, with that caveat.
but I was born into the 1970s. And I think what we remember are the obviously sensational attacks on public figures, but there was also regular political violence at that time, bombings that were occurring on a regular basis. And Professor Dugan, you may have more data on this, but it was a phenomenon that was not just targeting the leaders in our country. It was a phenomenon that people were experiencing in their communities, particularly in urban areas. And we also had tremendous uprisings in cities in the wake of those events. And so it's hard to compare. It's a different time. But I do think it is worth remembering that, yeah, it was a cataclysmic feeling for those people who were alive and experiencing that at that time.
And Professor Dugan, the idea that in that time they couldn't even fathom that social media would exist. I mean, they were just seeing it on the nightly news that was at a specific time. But now it's everywhere all the time. Is that why? I mean, you're saying there's more political violence now, but it also feels like it because it is everywhere on our phones.
Yes. Yes. And I'd like to point out that back in the 60s, television was still relatively new, in that when these uprisings and protests around Vietnam happened, people were seeing other students and other young people out there protesting and out there fighting, and so they joined in. And so technology had a role in sort of building a momentum of protests, and you know, with that, the civil rights movement and these leaders and the anti-war movement. And so much of the violence was, yes, there were assassinations against political leaders, but there was also violence from the left, trying to get the attention of the government in order to shut down the war. So what this country saw, and actually what was seen across the world, because the movement wasn't just contained in the United States, it was everywhere, was an uprising that was scary to a lot of the older people in particular, but it was frightening to a lot of people because this country at the time, and I think also now we have a large segment of people who are really invested in maintaining the status quo. Mm. And so when you have people pushing against the status quo, it can cause a lot of friction. And so having that on nightly news all the time was frightening. And so back to your question, here we have it not just on nightly news, but we see it everywhere. Mm-hmm. And our phones and social media are so addictive that, you know, people are at work looking and seeing what's happening next. People are posting on X, or they're posting on various social media platforms, and it's reverberating through the news, and people are choosing sides and pushing back, and so it feels a lot more salient today. Mm-hmm. But stepping over the threshold of actually committing violent acts, there's violence through rhetoric, which is mm-hmm. frightening, and has, you know, it actually can lead to physical violence, kinetic violence, but we see it all the time. And so I do think it's more salient, but I also think that it's actually more frequent than it was then, because the data I use started in 1970, so I don't have data that counts the number of incidents back in the 60s. But I think we've risen well above that. Our 1970 data shows really high levels of violence in the U.S., and we've peaked that.
Mm. Yeah, and Trevor, go ahead. Yeah,
I was just going to say, just think back to the iconic shooting of John F. Kennedy. Mm-hmm. The Zapruder film was something that I think was seared in people's brains as the singular image or singular event. And yet there were other assassinations mm-hmm. that occurred, and we had no record of them visually. So Martin Luther King's murder was not something that we saw. Mm-hmm. We saw pictures of the aftermath, but we did not see the event. Now, to just emphasize Laura's point, you could search and find, at this moment, we could call up any number of acts of political violence that we chose to see, that we would want to see. I think it's horrible that we would want to see that, but people have the ability to seek it out and see it in a way that they didn't back then.
And talk a little bit more, Trevor, about what Laura was saying about the violence of rhetoric versus the actual violence. Do you feel that is also more heated, not just on social media, but there's even bots out there that are making the rhetoric more heated?
Yeah, again, I wasn't around then, so I don't know how to describe mm-hmm. what might have occurred back then. But I can say that the experience of being a person, a citizen in the world today, is full of a lot of heated language, mm-hmm. I'm saddened by that, and I'm nervous about it, but it is the reality. And I think one of the roles that, and now I'm speaking as an educator, one of the things that we have to do is help people use language in a constructive way to identify our differences. We need to be aware of what makes us different and distinct from each other, while also having some shared understanding of who we are. And the best way we do that is through language, the words we choose.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about political violence with Laura Dugan, professor of sociology at Ohio State University, and Trevor Brown, dean of the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. Laura, how do you think we as a society should lower the temperature? Is there a way at this point to lower the temperature? And I guess that my other question was, whose responsibility is that?
So do you want my idealized version, or do you want a practical version?
Let's start practical.
Okay. So
you can idealize first if you want to.
Well, I mean, the idealized version is short. Yeah. The idealized version is that I think our political leaders need to be very cognizant of the effect of their words. Mm-hmm. I have conducted research, and my students have conducted research where we actually can link hostile rhetoric to violent outcomes, rises in hate crimes. And so, and I particularly am studying the rhetoric used by our leaders, our federal government leaders, as well as state leaders, and the effects of what they say has tangible outcomes. And so my idealized answer is that leaders should need to be more cognizant of the choices of their words, and that those values of respecting people across the aisle, across all ideologies, is really important. And I say that's idealized because I'm also well aware of that's not how you get reelected oftentimes. And so the political pressure is to polarize. Mm-hmm. And that's a sad state. So that's the idealized version. But the practical version is that we need to start with us. We need to be aware of how we talk to each other. We need to ask people about themselves and listen and not be prepared to show our points or be prepared to convince them. There's an organization, I think it's a national organization, but I just heard of it a few days ago, called Better Angels. I think it's called that.
And Braver Angels.
Braver Angels. Thank you.
It's a great organization.
Yeah. And so I'm getting some information of them, and it's about people who have differing opinions coming together and just talking. And there's some ground rules about it so that people can just listen to each other and recognize the humanity in the other person. And I think that's really how we need to operate. So this is a decision that each person needs to make for themselves. And what that means is that when we're in a room with somebody who's not making that decision, we still need to hold our ground in keeping that, which you know, it's playing the long game. And we may only have the long game left.
Trevor, you're in charge of the College of Public Affairs. Can you teach that to your students to be able to calm down and calmly explain yourself and hear both sides?
Yes, I it's a tough question to answer because on the one hand, you wish you could give people the words, but instead what you really have to do are try to create the conditions where people learn how to respect each other. If we all agree that we wish that people treated each other with more respect and dignity, there are ways to do that in a classroom, for example. Set the ground rules for how people will interact in that space and hope that it extends beyond that space. Mm-hmm. But in the big complex world in which we live in, and this is the hard part of being an educator, what we've learned is the classroom is a somewhat controlled environment. The mm-hmm. social media space and the world they live outside the classroom, it's much harder to go in and influence how that occurs. And that, I totally agree with Laura's point. I mean, there are so many structural forces at work, the leaders that the language they use, the way we conduct our politics, et cetera. But the most that we can do is influence our own behavior and the choices mm-hmm. we make. So trying to set good examples, try to model that, show others how to behave in a consensual and shared purpose way. Those are things we can do in and around the classroom, but the harder part is how we help young people in particular figure out how to interact with each other.
I wanted to pivot to talk about the idea of a free democratic society and whether political violence makes people afraid to participate. Do you, Trevor, feel like maybe people will be afraid to attend a rally or attend a protest because of the climate we're in?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's not lost on me that the sad assassination of Charlie Kirk occurred on a university campus, mm-hmm. which is an open space where we want to encourage people to come and be physically present and engage with each other. Absolutely. We know this from years of violence in the K-12 space. Kids are scared and anxious when they go to school. So are teachers. That, I think, is spreading throughout our public square. People are nervous.
And Laura, the sociology idea of that, do you worry that people will be afraid to do something as fundamental as vote because of the fear of violence? Because everything that is involved with politics now seems so contentious.
I do worry about that. I think that there are some people who are more determined than ever to vote, but those are probably people who would have voted anyway. Mm. I've heard a number of people say that they are just tuning out what's going on. because, I mean, for one thing, they feel like if they say anything about it, their livelihoods may be threatened. But also, it's hard stuff that's going on in the world. It's hard to look and see how people are treating each other, and the fact that somebody can be shot and like just assassinated right on a college campus just for speaking is very frightening. And so I think that people want to be happy and they want to have, you know, peaceful daily lives. And so they avoid social media, they avoid the news, and they spend more time doing the things they like, and which is all good and important mm-hmm. self-care work, but mm-hmm. it could lead to not voting.
Mm-hmm. One of the premises of the American democratic experiment is that we have citizen leaders. We have people who are citizens first, and then they run for office. And we do a lot of work with elected officials in the Glenn College, and increasingly, and this is at the local level, school boards, townships, many public officials are saying, or people who might be in citizens who might mm-hmm. be inclined to run for office have said, this is a scary endeavor. This is a dangerous path. And hence, I'm not going to choose that. And that is equally disheartening to people just not feeling that they can participate in the public square, is that in our American democracy, people don't feel that they can run for township trustee because of the potential violence that they will experience.
Laura, do you have any sense of the development of political violence over the years? Has it shifted from groups carrying out something that's planned as a group to individuals with complicated ideologies?
Yes, although I think that in the United States, it has often been about individuals carrying out attacks with complicated ideologies and psychologies. I'd say since the 90s, there has been most of the violence in the United States has been from the far right, and the far right has a whole lot of different ideologies within it. There's anti-government, more libertarian. There's anti-abortion, which is a single-issue movement, although it's enveloped with a lot of other ideologies. There's sort of the extreme religious ideologies, and so people should believe how I believe, and then neo-Nazis and things like that. So there's a lot of different ideologies involved. But what I study is like what makes somebody cross the line to actually perpetrate a violent event. And there's mm-hmm. been a lot more of it than reaches the news. Mm-hmm. And so the acts that have happened over the years have been really done by, they've been more impulsively planned than actually planned. So for instance, the Oklahoma City bombing, that was obviously mm-hmm. planned out for a while, but it was really just two people that were involved in it, mm-hmm. not a whole group of people that were involved, even though it's shined a light on a group of people that were part of this movement. So I would say that it's mostly been single groups mm-hmm. that have been involved.
Staying with us after the break, Laura Dugan, professor of sociology at Ohio State University, and Trevor Brown, dean of the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. And coming up, we're going to talk about how political violence affects free speech. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The assassination of Charlie Kirk has been felt across American society, with tensions extending to our online and in-person interactions. A database of individuals who insulted Kirk in the wake of his assassination was created, and late-night host Jimmy Kimmel was pressured into being taken off the air for almost a week. How do political violence events affect the way we talk to each other? How does it affect free speech? Still with us is Laura Dugan, the Ralph D. Mershon Professor of Human Security and Professor of Sociology at Ohio State University. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Trevor Brown, Dean of the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
So, Trevor, let's talk about free speech. It's a constitutional right, but the consequences of what you say, what happens afterward, is not necessarily protected. So where do you think we are in this country in the free speech debate right now?
Well, I think you just put your finger on the founding principle is that we should have it, and we should create the conditions for it to be present and expand. And I'm a believer in that. This goes back to the earlier part of this conversation where we talked about what should be the way we should be encouraging how we talk to each other. So I think the competition of ideas is the fundamental pathway to leading to a better place. I fundamentally believe in that. But helping people identify what is that shared and common purpose through free speech. Is the way that we should be doing that. And that's where you asked me earlier about what we can do in and around the classroom. That's where I think universities play one of the most essential roles in a free and democratic society. We are a place where the contestation of ideas should occur in a free speech environment, but we should be modeling how to have contentious disagreements across all sorts of different people should be welcome in universities, and we should be the place where we learn how to debate, to discuss, but then also how to engage in the shared purpose of improving the human condition.
Laura, there's the old adage that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, right? But you can say something negative about a national figure, knowing it will fan the flames of people in this country. Can you do that? Should you do that?
Those are two different questions. You can do that.
Yeah.
Should you do it? I mean, honestly, I think it depends. Mm-hmm. Fanning the flames is one thing, obviously, that is problematic. But I do think it's important to call out bad behavior when we see it. And I think it's important to call out when our values, our constitutional protections are being violated. And that could be, that is being interpreted as fanning the flames. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that that's necessarily true. Or sometimes we need to fan flames just to get the attention on something that may be compromising our democracy. I agree with everything that Trevor has said. One caveat that I would add is that I feel like this country has moved in a direction where it's much easier to ignore science, and it's much easier to ignore a number of things that have been shown to be true, and it's easy to just state things as facts even though they're not based in facts. And so I feel like it's really important that we teach our students to think critically about the information that is presented to them so that they can develop their own skills to discern what is accurate and what is inaccurate. And so they can look beyond just a meme and look for the science behind it and look for evidence that there is truth behind it. And I think that's going to be really important moving forward. And so coming back to your question about fanning the flames versus, can we do that or should we do that? No, I don't think we should be attacking somebody's being. But I think that when somebody does speak publicly, we can question it.
But Trevor, the idea of free speech is even if you say something that is not scientifically accurate, you're allowed to.
Correct.
Yeah,
that is absolutely correct. And here again, that's why we need to create environments where there's a competition of ideas so that the best ideas prevail. And some of those ideas, all of those ideas, we hope are rooted in facts and analysis. but they're also rooted in people's experiences. And I think in addition to perhaps ignoring some of the data that's present, I think we're increasingly comfortable with ignoring each other. And one of the things we have to work back towards is the fundamental skill of, yes, speaking, but the other half of speaking is listening. And that is the true secret sauce of a free speech environment, is we have to be able to listen and hear the arguments of someone who we disagree with, and then be able to process that in the way that Laura has said, through our critical thinking skills, et cetera, and be open to the idea that we might be wrong and they might be right for whatever the reasons that we find compelling. And again, here I come back to what is the role of a university in a free and democratic society? It is to create the conditions for what I just described to occur.
Mm. Laura, have you noticed or have you found any noticeable differences in your students in the past couple of weeks since the assassination of Charlie Kirk? Are students' interactions any different?
I'm currently teaching a graduate class in statistics, so
fun.
I think it is fun,
yeah,
to be honest. But there's some undergraduate students, but honestly, they're all from sociology. So I haven't noticed that they feel tense or anything like that, but it's also a very specific group of students. So,
Trevor, have you heard from some of your professors?
Yeah. Well, and it's I have the pleasure. One of the pleasures of being at a university is, in regardless of what role you're in, you do get to spend time with young people who are at this stage of exploration and they're inquisitive. I just met with a group of undergraduates earlier this week, and I don't know that I have a good explanation as to why. I have some hypotheses. It was a very engaged and enthusiastic group, and they were here to learn. They wanted to be challenged. I came away very hopeful that there is renewed energy. Some of it may be a COVID effect, a post-COVID effect. That was a different time, and people, I think, learned or got into some habits of interaction that weren't always healthful for the kinds of things we're talking about right now. And this group of students maybe is at the tail end of that experience. But there's nervousness, there's anxiety, but there is a lot of excitement and enthusiasm about being a person in the world.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about political violence and free speech with Laura Dugan, professor of sociology at Ohio State University, and Trevor Brown, dean of the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. I mentioned in the introduction, there's an online community that was created. They created a website for those who insulted or belittled the death of Charlie Kirk. And it's meant to be used to send evidence to employers or to peers. What do you two think about this? Does it set a dangerous precedent going forward? Or is this just the other foot of cancel culture that we're in right now?
Yes to both of them, to both of those statements. I mean, I find it frightening, particularly because the things that they're collecting and that they're criticizing and that they're putting in that database are things that I need to say because it's what my research is. Mm. And so just by speaking about my research findings, I could end up in a database that makes people want to be hostile toward me and or my family. That is very frightening. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm not going to not talk about what my research says, because mm-hmm. what's the whole point of conducting research if I hide the findings or only share it with other academics? And so it's very concerning for me, and I've lost some sleep over it. Mm-hmm. So yes. And then the other piece, you said the other side of cancel culture.
Well, it's yes. So you say something, they tell your employer, you know, feels like they have to discipline you or let you go to be able to move forward. You get canceled, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Do you, I mean, is that just the era we're living in? That you need to not say things publicly so that because of there's too many worries. Like, can free speech protect your job? I guess is where I'm getting at. Mm.
So in an academic environment, I can't speak to other employers other mm-hmm. than what I observe, but in an academic environment, we have this interesting overlay between free speech and academic freedom, mm. right? And so free speech is my right as a citizen guaranteed by the First Amendment to go out into the public square, and the public square is a metaphor. It could be online, it could be on the Oval, as long as I'm doing it in a way that adheres to time, place, and manner requirements. I'm allowed to say what I want to say. In a classroom and in my research, Laura is an amazingly trained expert in her research. She has knowledge that I don't have. The university is set up to protect and create the conditions for her to ask interesting questions in her field. And then whatever the data reveals is what the data reveals. There's no right answer. There's the answer that she and others come up with, and it's the purpose of the university to create that academic freedom environment and then allow her to disseminate that in the classroom. So one of my jobs is to first educate people about the difference. So Laura doesn't have the right to just walk into her classroom and say whatever she wants to say about any topic. But academic freedom creates the conditions for her to be able to share the findings of her research, even if those are controversial, even if they offend, even if they cause people discomfort. That is the protection that we should be putting in place and defending.
Yeah, a little bit more about this free speech and your job thing. So last week we saw late night host Jimmy Kimmel be taken off the air for comments he said about Charlie Kirk. That's an example of a private company. I mean, he didn't lose his job, but someone like basically losing their job over comments that what they said over free speech. Do you think we'll see more of it?
I do. Mm-hmm. I do think we'll see more of it, but I also think we'll see pushback. There was a lot of pushback mm-hmm. over Jimmy Kimmel's firing. There was people were responding by selling their stock in Disney and mm-hmm. protesting, and they were out there protesting, knowing that there may be risks involved. So Ted Cruz came out and spoke against it, mm-hmm. and so here we have people on both sides, like highly visible people from both the left and right, saying no, you can't do that because it really does compromise our values, our mm-hmm. values as Americans, and what we have in the Constitution, and so while I feel like there's a lot of pressure to try to control media and what people mm-hmm. say publicly, I'm happy to find that there's pushback and that people are standing up. So I do think we'll see more of it, but I think that I don't know where it's headed.
Right.
We are on the edge yeah. of.
Well, and we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask, historically speaking, I know your research dates back to the 70s, but is free speech something that has gone hand in hand with political violence over time, or does it feel more like we're having that debate right this second because people can rewatch videos of Charlie Kirk, people can watch the video of what Jimmy Kimmel said?
Well, what's really interesting about that is that a lot of research has shown that when things like free speech when democratic values are being compromised, things like free speech, freedom of press, and stuff like that, we're moving away from being a democracy toward autocracy. And because people don't have legitimate ways to change policy and to air their grievances, there's actually a rise in more political violence. Mm-hmm. And so there are two sides of that sword. There's those who can't speak and therefore, or those who can't have their needs met, or those who feel invisible that may act on their impulses and to try to be heard through violence. And then also there's this piece where people react to what others are saying and feel emboldened to commit violence because they hear people they respect saying harmful things. And so I feel like we're having both of that right now. Mm. And so I feel like the types of violence that we're going to be seeing in the future are going to come from a lot of different directions. And that is concerning.
Trevor, if you want the last word, about 30 seconds.
Just totally agree with Laura. But as I said before, I think speech is the pathway, the ability to call this the conversation we're having right now, to be able to, as a free society, discuss what does this mean to us? Are we happy with this? No. What is our shared and common purpose? We only figure that out by talking with each other. And you need free speech guardrails to be able to have those conversations in all sorts of fora. So it is the essential. There are trade-offs, obviously, but it is the essential building block on which we find our way out of this.
Well, I want to say thank you for joining us. Trevor Brown, Dean of the John Glenn College of Public Affairs, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And Laura Dugan, Professor of Sociology at Ohio State University, thank you so much for your time.
Sure. Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the influence of Charlie Kirk in Ohio and around the country. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. It's hard to overemphasize the influence and guidance Charlie Kirk had over many Americans, especially among young conservative voters. President Donald Trump even credited Charlie Kirk and his organization, Turning Point USA, with helping him secure the 2024 presidential race. How did Charlie Kirk become one of the Republican Party's most beloved leaders? And what does his unfortunate death mean for millions of Americans that listen to him? Joining us now is Aaron Baer, president of the Center for Christian Virtue and founder of the Ohio Christian Education Network. Thanks for joining us today, Aaron.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So starting off, why do you think Charlie Kirk's death was so devastating for so many Americans?
There's so many things that go into that. I think first and foremost, you know, there's few people that had the reach in the conservative movement and the Christian movement as Charlie Kirk, especially with the next generation. So many folks look to him as a leader, as a spokesperson for the things we care so much about. But then also the way he died and dying, doing the thing, being assassinated, doing the thing of trying to reach out to people who disagree with him and just trying to have an open conversation. Charlie would often say, when we stop talking is when violence comes about. Mm. And it's just so sad that violence came while he was talking and trying to have that conversation. That's what's resonated with so many people since his assassination and then in his very powerful memorial on Sunday.
Did you have a lot of interaction with Charlie Kirk over the years?
We met a number of times just through various events and traveling in somewhat similar circles. Wouldn't say we were friends by any stretch of the imagination. We had Charlie was supposed to speak for us in Cleveland tomorrow, actually. And I just saw him about 3 weeks ago at the Delaware County Republican Party event there. But very much an admirer of his, especially in these last years of his life, where he really leaned into speaking to the next generation about the importance of his belief in Jesus Christ and the importance of marriage and family.
He was obviously a big figure for President Donald Trump. It's not every day that a president attends and speaks at a funeral. What did you think of the president's remarks at the funeral?
Well, again, it's classic President Trump, but it just shows both the respect he had for him and also the fact that the vice president was there, that the Secretary of State was there. So many leaders spoke about Charlie and, importantly, his faith. I think the other thing, too, though, about Charlie is to understand that for generations, I you know, somebody who's worked in conservative politics for a long time, when somebody would come up and say, hey, I've got a great idea for turning out youth voters to vote for Republicans or conservatives, I say, I've got a great idea for that money too. Mm-hmm. Just set it on the ground and burn it because it doesn't work. And it'll save you a lot of time. But Charlie was the first one I've ever seen, and what he did with Turning Point USA to be able to reach that next generation and turn them out to vote. I mean, NPR had a really powerful story on this that just showed, and I think it was in Michigan, it was about a 24-point swing from Biden to Trump of voters 18 to 29, about 18 points in Pennsylvania. That's the Charlie Kirk and TPUSA effect.
You mentioned one of the things that made Kirk so famous were his campus debates. Did you always agree with everything you heard him say?
You know, I'd have to like think through if there was anything in particular that I didn't agree with. I certainly always agreed and appreciate that he was there to logic and reason. And you'll hear from people all the time that would say they'd sit down with Charlie and he was willing to change his mind. But I think for the most part, when you, and this is one of the hard parts about social media today, people will take little clips and say, oh, look how awful Charlie's views were on this. But when you saw that he would sit there for hours on end and reason with kids, and reason with anybody actually that would show up, you would see that he really did have a heart for our country, a heart for all people, and wanted to see, people thrive in our country today.
Obviously, no one deserves to be shot and killed. Charlie Kirk's death is a horrible tragedy, but he did enjoy a good debate. He enjoyed his debates. Do you think that his debates and some of his speeches did turn up the heat in this country a notch or two?
I think the heat in our country was already turned up. I think Charlie was willing to speak clearly about these things when so many other people were afraid. I mean, the reality is boys should not be playing in girls' sports, and transgender medicine on kids is sterilizing and dangerous. And Charlie was one of the people with the with that stage and platform that wasn't afraid of cancellation, that was willing to speak out clearly on this and take on any topic. And that's the good Charlie did in our country today.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Charlie Kirk with Aaron Baer, president of the Center for Christian Virtue and founder of Ohio Christian Education Network. You mentioned that tomorrow the Center for Christian Virtue is holding a Cleveland gala, and originally Charlie Kirk was supposed to be the keynote speaker. Tell me about the decision to still decide to hold this event.
You know, this took a lot of prayer for us. We actually closed our office the day after the assassination just because a lot of our team needed to mourn. I needed to mourn it, not just what happened to Charlie, but what it says about our country. But we got so much feedback from folks that they wanted to get together. Now, I mean, people want to do something after this. This is what's so different, even about the attempted assassination of President Trump. Is that people's response of this is not just mourning, but drive to say, how are we going to make a difference? I mean, I was told by one pastor at Rock City Church in Columbus, they had 1,900 people show up for the first time the Sunday after Charlie's assassination. So people are hungry to do something. So we decided we're still going to go forward. Actually, one of Charlie's pastors, Pastor Luke Barnett from Dream City Church in Phoenix, is coming out. And then Allie Beth Stuckey, who hosted Charlie's program for him last week or this week, earlier this week, she's coming out now as well as we honor Charlie and then talk about where we go from here.
So the decision to hold the event, though, are you changing things? What's security going to be like? Are you worried?
Yeah, you know, honestly, for this one, security's already pretty high there. The one we had to really think about security on is the next week is the Ohio March for Life. You know, that's 3,000 to 4,000 people, open air in the downtown, outside the State House in downtown Columbus. That's where we've really upped security. And law enforcement's been great working with on that. But again, the idea that this Charlie's assassination changed the way we view the world in the most practical ways. I've walked on the State House grounds hundreds of times, and this was the first time this week walking on there. And then I'm looking around and noticing balconies and noticing rooftops that a assassin could go on, a shooter could go on. Right? I've never looked at it that way before. And this is just the sad reality of where we are today in our country.
So what changes did you make for the Ohio March for Life? What did you ask for, what the security was?
Well, I got to say, we really didn't have to ask for much. Columbus PD and state troopers and others came. They understand the gravity of this situation. So they've upped security. I'm going to not get into all of the different things that they're going to be doing to keep people safe there that day. But there will be a much larger police presence to maintain order, to make sure people are safe, but also make sure we have to keep going forward. You know, that day, that shooter questioned the sanctity and dignity of every single life. And that's why we march in the Ohio March for Life is for that very purpose. So, we have to go forward.
There's been a lot of heated rhetoric from both sides of the aisle since the Kirk assassination. In your eyes, where do you think we should go from here? I mean, you're still holding your events. That's a symbol of moving forward. What else do you comes to mind as steps forward?
Well, you know, Amy, for us, we believe that where everything starts is belief in Jesus Christ. And so that's why we continue to move forward and proclaim that good news that every life matters and that they are loved dearly by their creator. Where we go forward from here is to speak more boldly. I think that's the thing everyone feels encouraged right now by carrying the mantle for Charlie, is going into spaces where people might disagree and engaging in those conversations. I think social media has fooled us into thinking we're having real conversations today, but the way Charlie did it and it is a lesson for all of us on how we can go into places that might not agree with us and have those conversations and trust. Yeah, there might be the noise on the outside, but one-to-one hearts and minds can change.
Yeah. So Charlie Kirk, a proud Christian, he built his platform on promoting Christian values through American politics. How do Christian values fit into this heated rhetoric? The country is becoming more and more polarized. Now, I think that Charlie Kirk's widow saying that she forgives the killer is a big showing of her values. Is there anything else that comes to mind besides that forgiveness quote?
Well, I mean, I actually think you said something interesting there that I think is an important nuance about the way Charlie views things. And honestly, the way we view things, it's not about advancing our Christian views or values through politics. It's that we have Christian views and they influence how we engage all of the world. And so that influenced the way we engage in politics as well, but also how we lead our family. I think sometimes there's this view of things that the Christians are trying to force our views on other people through politics. No, we're just participating in the democratic process as anybody else is. And the same way anybody else voting their values isn't trying to force their values on anyone else. They're just saying, hey, this is the direction I think we should go. And that's what Charlie did very clearly. And he wasn't afraid to say, hey, my Christian views most align with this party. It seems like the Republican Party is going to do the most to protect these things. And so that's who I'm going to work with to get this done. And so that's an important nuance about him. And I do think for all of us, looking at what's happening in our world, looking at the struggles we have in our communities, how does our faith motivate us to get involved is really where I see Charlie's legacy living on.
Well, Erica Kirk offered her forgiveness, showing her Christian values, but not everyone has gone that far. Do you wish that there's a few other politicians out there who could follow her lead?
Well, I think generally having more forgiveness and more grace in our culture is a great thing. I think Erica Kirk did something absolutely incredible there. I also think, though, that consequences are appropriate, right? I think what we learn in the Bible is that holding grudges against people does more to our heart and more damages to us than to the individual. But the government does carry the sword and has to have consequences. And so we do support, you know, Erica still certainly does support the governmental process working out on this on this shooter. And so I think we need to be careful of understanding, yes, there should be forgiveness, but there are consequences to our actions. I think what happened with Jimmy Kimmel is a great example. There's consequences to saying terrible things. Now, he's got a show back and he's going, that's fine. But anybody who says something terrible like that, there's probably going to be consequences to it.
Well, the idea of consequences for saying something is coming out in some of the racist comments that Charlie Kirk has made, where he, you know, there's different things that he said about Black people not being smart enough and things of that nature. So that's coming out a lot right now, where people don't want to observe a moment of silence because of some of Charlie Kirk's past comments. What would you say to that?
I would say that's a perfect example of people zeroing in on 45-second clips or even 3 to 5 minute clips and not seeing the totality of Charlie's work. If you look at the TPUSA movement and the people Charlie worked with, you will see peoples of all backgrounds, of all colors, of all, you know, sexes, of both sexes, I should say. And they understood what Charlie's comments were on those issues. Charlie was just okay. If somebody's going to take an uncharitable view of what he was saying, he wasn't going to spend his time with them on those things. But the idea that Charlie Kirk was a racist is so far afield from reality. And you could see that he actually had racists show up at some of his events, and the way he would tear these people apart that would try to say Black people or other folks were lesser than or less valuable or less smart, he would tear them down, because that's not Charlie's views. That's not a Christian view. And that's certainly not what anybody associated with TPUSA believes.
We have less than a minute left, but what was Charlie Kirk's influence here in Ohio? Can you put a finger on that, like of how he, like anything here specifically for Ohio politics?
Yeah, I mean, I think a few things. One, Charlie, and you saw this both with J.D. Vance, and I think you see this with Bernie Moreno now. Charlie's ability to encourage Christians and Republicans to go into any audience and have direct conversations, but also not be bullied into, hey, well, that's a racist thing you said, or that's a sexist thing to say, when it wasn't a racist or a sexist thing. It was a common sense thing. Charlie's willingness to just speak facts, you see that that's showing up in so many other places. And that's why we have great leaders like Bernie Moreno, like Vivek Ramaswamy, like J.D. Vance, all coming from Ohio. They're all very much in that Charlie Kirk vein. And it's incredible that all those guys are older than Charlie, but they would all tell you he had a profound influence on them.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to Aaron Baer, president of the Center for Christian Virtue and founder of the Ohio Christian Education Network. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Amy.
This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen back at WOSU.org/allsides. You can subscribe to our podcast or listen using the free mobile app. This is 89.7 NPR News.